Diane Rehm. Journalism was once considered a public service. Today, major corporations expect it to be a profit center. The recession and the information should be free ethos of the internet have dealt a double blow to investigative and local reporting. But organizations like MinnPost, The Voice of San Diego, and our own NPR are increasingly stepping in to fill the gap. Joining me to talk about how these organizations are competing and sometimes working with traditional news providers, Bill Buesenberg with the Center for Investigative Journalism, and Stephen Engelberg of ProPublica, joining us from his office in Santa Cruz, California, is Ken Doctor. He's author of a new book titled Newsonomics. And throughout the hour, we'll look forward to hearing your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Ken, I know there are lots of nonprofit news organizations popping up across the country. Talk about why.
Sure. There are now dozens of them, and it's an amazing phenomenon, especially coming out of the recession. We've got to look at it against that backdrop of the unprecedented change in for-profit journalism, and just a couple of headlines there. Basically, newspaper industry is down about $20 billion a year in revenue every year. We figure there's 12 to 15,000 fewer daily journalists than just 4 or 5 years ago. And my calculations tell me there's probably a million newspaper stories, daily newspaper stories in the U.S. not being written this year that would have been written in 2005. So we have these amazing changes in newspapers, also broadcast journalism, lots of cutbacks. And the gap you mentioned is a big one, but it's largely invisible. It's hard for people to know, what they don't read and what they don't see reported. But against that backdrop of major loss in reporting, we're seeing the national investigative organizations, as on the phone today, and dozens literally across the country trying to bridge that gap.
Hmm. Bill Buesenberg, as former vice president of NPR, are nonprofit news organizations doing things in a new way?
Yes, and in some ways the old way, but I was just looking at the number of reports we've done in the last year. We've done something like 450 investigative reports with 21 major partners, from the New York Times to the Washington Post to the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, to NPR, et cetera. So in a way, we are filling this invisible gap you talked about with investigative work, but we're also doing it digitally. So it's huge. It's so much different than just putting it in a newspaper. And I will say the numbers of people using this work, because the way the web works, clearly it's viral. I mean, we can count 3,300 different publications and online sites and Huffington Post, et cetera, that are picking it up and using it. So the work is spreading and going everywhere, and it's part of this new ecosystem that we're going to be talking about.
So, Stephen Engelberg, while some of these organizations have been in existence for quite a while, for example, NPR, you at ProPublica, just 2 years old, won a Pulitzer Prize this year. Tell us about how you do what you do.
Well, we've been very fortunate to have substantially good funding. We started with a budget of $10 million a year, which allowed us to go out and hire some 18 full-time reporters And that was really the beginning of being able to do the kind of work that doesn't get done so much these
Where
days.
Where did that $10 million come from?
The largest majority of it came from Herb and Marian Sandler, who had been bankers in California and had seen this crisis coming several years out. We have been busily fundraising to sort of diversify our funding, and this year we will be up to 40% of our money coming from foundations, individuals, and others who are not the Sandlers. But the Sandlers remain our largest donors. And again, as I said, they saw this coming. They were very, very astute business people. They saw the disaster that would be the economics of the news business, as Ken Doctor was talking about.
So Bill Buesenberg, Mother Jones magazine's been around, what, since 1970? You had this huge splash from Mother Jones with General McChrystal. I mean, are more and more... Sorry, Rolling Stone, are more and more of these small nonprofits doing more of the work that the big news organizations used to do?
I think there's no question about it. A year ago, we brought together about 25 of these new investigative centers. We formed something called the Investigative News Network. There's now 32 of these centers working together, beginning to do editorial collaborations, beginning to raise money together. There is a new ecosystem which is filling this gap that we're discussing. And I think doing really, in many, many cases, and I can just talk about the center's work, it's being used everywhere. We had a big piece on sex trafficking in the Washington Post on Sunday. CBS News on Friday, Katie Couric was using a report we did on the Legal Services Corporation and the problems they have with fraud and oversight. I mean, the work is getting used, but it's being done increasingly by these kind of nonprofit centers.
How are you making your money? Where is your money coming from?
The center is 20 years old this year, and we're celebrating our anniversary. We have about 50 different foundations that support us and have supported us really well, and increasingly individuals, small donors, members who support the center, and increasingly major donors. And all of them are saying to us, we understand that watchdog journalism is threatened. Democracy needs this. Citizens need this kind of information. We want to make sure that people who are doing this kind of investigative watchdog work are healthy.
And Ken, how are these organizations able to pay competitive prices to their reporters?
Well, as both Steve and Bill are talking about, at right now where we're at, we're very early. So this is major foundation support. Foundations, a number of them mentioned, also the Knight Foundation in Miami, have said they understand what's going on. We're basically at the beginning of a three-year cycle where they're saying, we see a need, a public need, and we're going to help fund it. But we hope you guys can figure out some ways that you're not always going to be dependent on foundation money. So I'm more worried on the local end. I think what these two organizations and others are doing on the national end is really an engine of national change. And we see those national companies like Frontline and New York Times able to help pay the freight. On a local basis, we're talking about small organizations of 6 to 12 to maybe 20 journalists. And they're right now foundation funded. They're looking to membership programs. MinPost, which you mentioned, has now 2,000 members in the Twin Cities, which is nice, but still a small amount of money. They're looking for the same kind of essentially syndication that the national organizations are doing, but of course there's not as much money there. And they're looking at advertising and sponsorship, but they're starting at the very beginning. So they're just really building new business models, and that is an important one, where in the Bay Area, for instance, where I live, the Mercury News used to have 400 people in the newsroom, now has 125.
Wow.
And, you know, you have a startup like Bay Citizen, which is a good startup, but they've got, you know, they've got maybe 10 people. So the scale of difference, the scale of change is what I think we've all got to be concerned about as readers and citizens.
But, Stephen, it does sound a little like the NPR model with members starting small, foundations, grants, that kind of thing.
Yes, I think there's hope there. But I think Ken is making a very important point. Before I was at ProPublica, I was had the sort of title that was sort of a little bit dispiriting, managing editor slash print. And I left in late 2007, and between that date and today, the newsroom at the Oregonian, a very fine regional paper, has fallen by 50%. And while, in all fairness, as a print guy, I would say to you, some of those stories, those million stories a year that aren't being written, probably we could do without. A whole bunch more we still need. And it's just the physical presence. It's the people going to the police station every day, going to the courthouse, the two or three people who are bugging the mayor's office, which becomes one or maybe a half.
So you're talking the local stuff.
Yes.
That's not being done.
Well, it's just slow to start. As,
yeah.
As Ken is saying, when you move from, you know, when you lose 250 people at the, you know, San Francisco Mercury, San Jose Mercury, you're not going to replace that with 12 very, very active young Internet people. It's just not going to be the same.
Bill Buesenberg, what about the Center for Public Integrity and Local Focus?
Well, we do have projects that run in all 50 states, and we increasingly see the need for coverage in every state capital. So we have different projects we're designing where we can do 50 state projects, plus the collaboration that we are talking about with these members, the Investigative News Network, who are members often in state capitals, but at the local level. I do see this new collaboration between large national groups like ours, like the Center for Public Integrity, and the smaller groups as part of our future.
Bill Buesenberg, he was Vice President for News for National Public Radio. He is currently Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity. Short break, right back.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11.
You value WAMU 88.5 as a shared community resource. Help support it. Your membership contribution will help yourself as well as the entire community by keeping valuable programs on the air. Call 800-248-8850 or give online at WAMU.org.
74 degrees in Northwest Washington. It's 10:19.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And as we talk about the future of not-for-profit journalism, Bill Buesenberg is with me. He's Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity. Also, Steve Engelberg, he's here in the studio. He's Managing Editor of ProPublica. Ken Doctor is on the line with us. He's author of the book titled Newsonomics and News Industry Analyst for Outsell. He spent 21 years with Knight Ridder and blogs at newsonomics.com. Here's an email from Mike in Shaker Heights, Ohio. He says, I've read many articles and heard many shows on alternative models for transmitting the news, one of which is the not-for-profit model. One problem I rarely hear addressed is that the American public no longer trusts most journalists or news outlets. How do your guests think that not-for-profit models will address the lack of trust in journalism? Stephen Engelberg.
Well, I think we're all trying to address it in similar ways. We make a real effort at ProPublica to be transparent about what we do, to tell our readers where things come from, why we're doing them. When we make an error, which does occur at all news organizations from time to time, we're very straightforward in explaining it. We have from time to time, explained to readers that we got something wrong. Trust is won over time, and there is a lot going on right now that cuts against trust in the media landscape. You know, you have these kind of partisan talk shows, partisan television, partisan news. It's entirely possible to live in a universe today in which you never hear anything that disagrees with your own opinion. So it's hard to build trust if your story happens to go against that grain.
And, you know, Bill Buesenberg, it's interesting that when that Rolling Stone piece came out about General McChrystal, there were howls from some people saying that that reporter overstepped his bounds. I mean, aren't you kind of between a rock and a hard place as to what you should write, what you may not write?
Well, I just, you know, to answer the question that the from the email, we're all working on this. I think we've established an amazing track record, at least at the center. And the way we do our work, it's almost always based on documents and data. We file freedom of information requests over and over and over and, of course, sue the government to get information. There is tremendous ability to say, okay, here's our story. Here's the document it's based on. You know, we did this story on the subprime 25. Who were the people that helped bring down the financial system, something you were talking about recently? You know, we went through 7.5 million mortgages to find out who were the top subprime lenders. We put that in there. We put the list in there. You can read it. And I think increasingly this new era that we're heading into, and we are in a transition. We aren't there yet. But where we're heading, it's going to be visible to people. They can look at the documents. They can look at the data. They can see the facts behind the reporting. And that kind of transparency, I think, does engender trust.
But, Ken Doctor, why should not-for-profit make a difference in the way people feel about journalists and what they're doing?
Well, it may make a difference in that all of us that have worked for profit-making and now profit-seeking media always had a delicate balance there, where as an editor, you always do the stories that you think need to get done. You resist commercial pressures that are always out there, and there are sometimes political pressures. And the American press overall has done a good job on that. But it doesn't surprise me, and some things I think don't change, that the trust in institutions generally, of course, is down across the board. The press has never been high, even before the Internet. Now, maybe, with nonprofits, it is, at this point anyways, a purer mission in a way, that if you're a nonprofit and you're as transparent as these organizations are and are trying to be, and communicate that clearly to the readers can have a better idea of exactly what they're doing and maybe not have this mistrust in the back of their minds that commercial pressures are determining what they're writing.
Ken Doctor, he's author of Newsonomics and joining us now from, pardon me, his office in Austin, Texas, Evan Smith. He's CEO and editor of the Texas Tribune. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell us about the Texas Tribune, why you left the Texas Monthly.
Well, I've been at Texas Monthly for 18 years and for the last almost 10 years running it, and believed that the work on the for-profit side of our business was going along well enough without me, and that there was important work to be done that was not getting done by my colleagues at the newspapers in Texas, covering in particular politics and public policy at the state level. What you heard in the first portion of the show is exactly the case in Texas 20 years ago. There were three times the number of people covering the Texas Capitol as there are today. 20 years ago, there were two daily papers in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and El Paso. There are many fewer papers, many fewer reporters, and therefore less coverage of very important state issues. And I thought, with a number of other journalists here, that we could start a nonprofit news organization, raise money from private individuals, from foundations, and create an organization dedicated entirely to filling in the gaps that existed at newspapers and other for-profit media around the state.
So what difference do you think the nonprofit route has made for you?
I would ape what I heard a few minutes ago, in that I think not being beholden to shareholders, not being out there for commercial considerations, simply being about the work. We remind people we're not so much nonprofit as non-taxable, technically. The money comes back in. We're happy to make money, but we put all the money back into the organization in the form of paying reporters a good wage. They're professionals and should be paid professionally. We've tended to forget that journalists are professionals, and so we've believed from the very beginning in paying people competitively with the for-profit guys. And we put our money toward the use of technology to tell stories in a real 21st century way. We came out of the gate, Diane, as a true multi-platform organization telling stories across text and audio and video, database journalism, events as journalism, and we're device agnostic. We want anybody who encounters us on a computer or on a cell phone or on a tablet to be able to access our stuff. So we've built an organization that relies on contributions to fund our operations, but because we're not out there chasing profits and not trying to satisfy shareholders, the considerations are somewhat different from what they'd be at a for-profit media company.
What about the other Texas newspapers? How have they reacted to what you're doing?
Well, all but the biggest ones don't have their own capital coverage. At best, they're paying the Associated Press more than $2 a circulation head, and at worst, they're getting virtually no coverage at all of statewide issues. So when we came along and said we're going to create this content, we have a dozen reporters on staff, many of them names known to these newspapers. The reporters are known to them. And we're going to provide this to you for free because our syndication model, unlike some nonprofits, is that we give the content away. We don't ask anything for it. They said, terrific. Where do we sign up? And the medium-sized and small papers in particular have been running our stuff from the beginning. The bigger guys were a little slower to embrace what we're doing because they saw us, not without some merit, as competitive. They have their own staffs, however slim down they may be. And they said, well, you're answering a question no one's asking. There's not a need for more content. Otherwise, we'd be providing it. And anyway, what you create is going to compete with what we're creating. So they were a little standoffish about us, but over time we won them over with the quality of our work and with our honoring the promise that we were not looking to duplicate what they were doing, but that we were trying to, in baseball terms, hit them where they ain't, go after the areas of coverage not being provided by those papers.
So what's next?
Well, we're collaborating, our reporters and their reporters, on major projects that run concurrently on the Tribune site and in the newspapers. They're running, the big papers are, in almost all cases now, our stories much more regularly. And we're making national content partnership deals as well. And we are part of a circle of folks, some represented on this show and some out there in the world. We're all brothers and sisters in arms here in trying to provide another route for this good, important public service journalism to get in the hands of as many people as possible. There may be fewer places to go to get public service journalism, but the problems that we all face in our communities have never been greater. This stuff matters, and all of us have got to figure out new ways to get it out into the hands of as many people as possible.
So help me to understand this. Instead of looking for subscriptions, you're looking for members.
We do indeed. And like MinnPost, although we've been around a little bit less time, we've only been up and running for about 9 months, Diane, we have also almost 2,000 members. We have more than 100 corporate sponsors. We've raised about $1.5 million from foundations toward a total that we've raised so far of about $5 million to support our operations. And, you know, we believe if you build a sustainable business model, if you run this like a for-profit rather than a nonprofit and you don't rely on one source, we raise money from members, we raise money from major donors, from corporate sponsors, from foundations, and earned income through premium content that we make you pay for, not very much of our content you have to pay for, but a little bit, and through the events that we put on, we think there are enough dollars going in enough of those buckets that we can do this. It is not a subscription model, and it's not an advertising model, but it's a membership model and an underwriting model. And public radio has proven successful at doing this, and we think we can prove successful at doing it as well.
Evan Smith, he's CEO and editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune. He spent nearly 18 years as president and editor-in-chief of the Texas Monthly. Thanks so much for joining us. And it would seem these models are just popping up all over the place, Bill Buesenberg.
Yeah, bravo to Evan Smith. Congratulations to what he's doing and what they're doing at the Texas Tribune. It is, I mean, you heard the enthusiasm, the energy, and the fact that he's filling an incredibly important gap at that level in investigative journalism and, you know, doing it with some of the best people in the business. That's what I think all this model, what we all share, that the best investigative reporters around are gravitating to these nonprofit centers to do this work.
So, Ken Doctor, what does that mean in the future for newspapers like the New York Times, like the LA Times, like the Washington Post?
It, it, it will vary a lot. So the New York Times is really taking a different route. And while the New York Times is, you know, obviously a New York metropolitan paper, less than half its circulation now comes in print from New York. So what they're doing as a national paper is they are aggressively now partnering with these kinds of companies. So Bay Citizen, which I mentioned in the Bay Area here, Chicago News Cooperative in Chicago, are both providing content to the New York Times, which, interestingly, they're using in print on Friday and Sunday. And they are using that to gain circulation for the New York Times and then also to increase readership online. So the New York Times has said they would like to have 10 or 15 of these kinds of regional editions within the next couple of years. So the Times can do that. The LA Times is really a very different kind of creature now than the New York Times, although it wasn't 20 years ago. And for these large metro papers, this is where we've seen the real carnage. These are the ones that are down by more than half. So some of them are partnering. LA Times has partnered with California Watch, which is an operation not too dissimilar from Evan Smith's Texas Tribune. And they are trying to figure that out, but they also have just a huge problem because their business model is continuing to be weak. So this is working. My headline would be on this, that it is working, and the passion that you hear is really an important part of it. I'm still concerned about how much of it gets done as these tremendous cuts have an impact on what we all read.
Ken Doctor, he's the author of a book titled Newsonomics, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll go to the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Michael, who's in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. It's always a pleasure to listen to your show.
Thank you.
My paper in Baltimore is the Sun, and it used to be called the Paper of Mencken. Now, I don't want to blame the staff, but since the buyout by, I think, either the Chicago Tribune parent company or the, I think it was first the LA Times and then the Tribune bought them, there just doesn't seem to have been any hard-hitting journalism for at least a few years. And there's stuff that if it offends the local establishment, it won't get printed. So I end up seeing more about local issues in the New York Times than I do in our paper. And so I welcome any kind of effort to bring back hard news journalism. It seems they missed the revolution with the computers by a few years, and when they finally got on board, it's like, you know, it seems a little too late. But, I mean, people are smart, and one thing you want to – people want good information, you know.
Sure. Stephen.
Well, I love hearing calls like this. Because I think it underscores something. There is an easy way that we sometimes were saying in print journalism, well, the readers just aren't reading us anymore. It's their fault. The truth of the matter is that if the newspaper doesn't serve its audience, the audience will go elsewhere. People are reading as much today as they ever did. They're just not reading as much print. Now, this gentleman is clearly hungry for a aggressive, assertive, probing local news source. And God love him. And I hope he gets it in Baltimore.
I hope so, too. To Gary, who's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi, and thanks. I remember hearing a joke a couple of years ago about how PBS stood for the Petroleum Broadcasting Corporation. And I'm just curious why we think that public broadcasting is any more independent of the large large donors than commercial broadcasting is not independent from advertisers. And I guess my second question related is if someone could comment on the BBC model, which I understand BBC is owned by the British and financed by the British government. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for calling, Bill Buesenberg. You've been at NPR long enough to know, as I do, that donors, large or small, have no impact on what I as a broadcaster do?
There really is a firewall system in place at NPR. I'm proud to say that was part of the effort when I was there. It exists today. Yes, they take underwriting. Yes, they take corporate support. Yes, they have underwriting credits, and they take foundation support. This is not free to produce. I think we all value National Public Radio and what it does, but it does require money to do it. And what's important then is to set up a firewall between the editorial side and the choices they make and the underwriting side. I'll just mention the BBC, which is a different model. It's a terrific institution. When I was at National Public Radio, I got to stay at the BBC for 3 years and work out of there. But they do take government support and license fees from individuals.
Taxpayer money.
Yeah, but they have a terrific service, and it sets a standard in that country.
Bill Buesenberg, we'll be right back.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Tonight at 6, we present the debut of a 5-part series, Snap Judgment. The first episode is called 5150, Danger to Self, featuring stories of people who are their own worst enemy, from the hallways of a psychiatric ward to an obsession over a late-night talk radio host. The debut of Snap Judgment, a new series, tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, the upcoming political battles over redrawing the voting lines and why it will affect elections for the next decade. Plus, the new intercity buses are cheap, wired for Wi-Fi, and maybe even fashionable. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And here's an email from Jonathan in Washington, D.C. He said, your last guest nailed it. It's about not being beholden to advertisers or shareholders. It allows other papers to go to the nonprofits like ProPublica for stories that wouldn't make it past the editorial discussions and producers' decisions. Go nonprofit journalism. It's the best stuff to read and regain faith in the system. As of this show, I'm going to be an individual sponsor of as many of these organizations as possible. You go, Jonathan, who's also a member of WAMU. Let's go to Nathan, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
So I've been in New Orleans the last 4 years, and I just wrote a story about how citizen journalists and bloggers have affected policy in post-Katrina New Orleans. I wrote it for Good Magazine, and one of the examples I used was A.C. Thompson from ProPublica, who first broke the case about white vigilantes in December of 2008 for The Nation, and then there was a partnership formed between ProPublica, The Times-Picayune, The Nation, and Frontline to help them further investigate that story, and then it basically led to an FBI investigation of the New Orleans police force, and then has led to major reform in the police force. And that story just broke again in the front page of the New York Times on this week. And the reporter for the New York Times didn't mention any of the reporting that was done that led to this investigation. And I thought that was really interesting because in every other news source, they talked about the journalists who were the harbinger for that case. And
Steven,
I was interested to hear what the guests thought about about that case.
Well, I am very proud of A.C. Thompson's work on that. He's a full-time reporter at ProPublica. We hired him when he was just beginning this work, and we have done with him and in our conjunction with actually Frontline and the New Orleans Times-Picayune some extraordinary journalism. Most recently, I think the caller is referring to the fact that on the front page of the Times-Picayune, we identified a white gentleman who had attempted to kill an African-American man. He had not been charged at that point. We ran his picture on the front page of the Times-Picayune. Our lawyers gulped a little bit, a tiny bit, but we went with the story, and it's an extraordinary thing. He was charged this week by a federal grand jury with civil rights violations, and so far some 16 New Orleans police officers have either charged or pled guilty to various offenses stemming from their behavior during the post-Katrina period. This is an extraordinary example of a reporter making a difference.
Did I understand Nathan to say that when the New York Times picked up the story, ProPublica was not given credit?
Well, you know, we live in the sort of internet world where being generous with others is both a sort of good act just because it's good, but also good for readers to know where things come from.
That's transparency.
I certainly would have been happy if my former colleagues, I worked in the New York Times for 18 years, my former colleagues and friends had seen fit to mention ProPublica. But I'm going to assume that, like my own work in the New York Times, sometimes things get cut for space, and I'm sure there's a paragraph out there somewhere that said it.
Thanks for calling, Nathan. Back to your comments about the BBC, Bill. What about Lee Bollinger's comments in the New York Times? In the Wall Street Journal op-ed about journalism needing government help?
Well, you know, public radio does get support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, not nearly the support that the British government provides to the BBC, I might say. Again, I think there's room for that in all kinds of ways, from corporations and government and others, as long as you have an established firewall and you set up an investigative operation that is not tainted by where the funds are coming from. I think it's possible. In our own case, we actually don't take, at the Center for Public Integrity, we do take money from individuals and foundations. Thanks for all of that support. We don't take even corporate money or direct government money at all. We think, and we make it transparent where that money comes from. We think that's really important to show how we raise the money, who it's from, and how we use it. So I'm not against government support for public radio or others.
What kinds of salaries can you afford to pay?
We pay pretty competitive salaries. I'm proud of what we do. They're probably too low if my staff is listening right now across the board. But we're working hard.
Give me a range.
We pay over $100,000 for really excellent reporters. They do well. They're not as many as maybe our friends at ProPublica have, but we do pay a good salary for great people, and we're. You know, all the time we're getting more and more people, excellent people, who are looking for this kind of work, who want to really do investigative work at a high level. So we're finding that we can hire all kinds of people now.
What about you, Stephen?
We're the same. We're in New York, so salaries are even perhaps a little bit higher. But we made a decision from the beginning that we would go out and try and get the best in the business. You certainly... I think in the investigative world, there is such a premium on accuracy and precision. And I'm proud to say that we were able to pay people the kinds of salaries that they were accustomed to making at fine newspapers. We hired from the LA Times, from the Washington Post, and other places. And this is an issue. There's no question about it. There is an issue in some of these smaller places. You know, can they grow into a point where they can pay a living wage?
Sure.
It's one thing if you're in your 20s. It's another thing if you have kids, a family,
yeah,
et cetera.
Absolutely. Is it liberating for you not to have to publish every day?
Well, this is the best job of my life. I am having the best time a journalist could possibly have. We come to work every day and publish, the stories, as Evan said, hit them where they ain't. We go places where work is needed, and we try to break news that wouldn't happen otherwise. And, you know, on the internet, of course, you do have a certain pressure to publish, but you don't, you know, when I was at the Oregonian, December 26th was a tough day. Kind of hard to fill your newspaper on December 26th, and I don't miss having to think of a big front page story for December 26th.
How about you, Bill?
It's the same thing. We do publish our big projects when they're ready, and that's a real luxury. I will say that we have a very big project coming out with the BBC on Wednesday. You will hear it worldwide because they're using a whole bunch of our reports.
Tell us what it's about.
I can't tell you what it's about.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's about a exporting of a carcinogen all around the world that will really literally kill 5 to 10 million people in the period ahead, and it's very serious. The BBC, we've kept this under wraps for quite a while, but you'll hear it on Wednesday, and it'll make some news. But you know, it's the kind of way we're able to work. That took 6, 8, 9 months of our work to get that project and make it real, and again, find a really good partner, and they love the story. So we're that's how we work.
Can't even NPR afford to do that anymore?
Well, NPR does have a very good investigative editor working now. They are doing investigative pieces. I give Vivian Schiller, the president of NPR, great credit. She's moved in that direction, and Ellen Weiss, the head of news. So they are doing more, and they're open to collaborations. We did this campus assault project, a big project on campus rape that we, again, worked on for almost a year and came to NPR. Many of your listeners may have heard parts of that. They did four different pieces based on that work. I'm really proud of what we did and what we were able to do with them. I will say we did a check of how many people listened, heard, watched, saw, read some part of that, because we had 64 college papers. We had all of these people collaborating with us. We can show that 40 million people heard, read, saw, watched some part of that project when it went out. So, you know, this is reaching a major audience.
Stephen.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that we also have worked with NPR recently on a story about traumatic brain injury. And in that case, which I think was a first for our organization and theirs, the collaboration was built in from the beginning, where Danny Zwerdling of the NPR staff and T. Christian Miller of our staff worked together side by side, shoulder to shoulder for many months to develop a story. And, you know, that is a collaborative model where you're getting the best of both organizations.
And Danny was on this program talking about that. To Coconut Grove, Florida. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm a senior citizen here in South Florida, and the only radio that I can listen to is NPR. We have the music, sports, Savage Republicans, Limbaugh, Hannity, Levin, and not one progressive station. And I fear it's going to really show in the next elections. So I'll leave it at that, Diane.
Interesting point. Ken Doctor, what do you make of that?
Well, it is the nature and the split between commercial radio and public radio. And one of the big questions coming out of that call and a few of the others is the kind of local news reporting we may see coming out of public radio stations. So they have been radio stations, and just like newspapers have been newspapers and TV has been TV. Corporation for Public Broadcasting has put, I think, $6 million into a local reporting project. We're seeing about a half dozen local but metro-sized public radio stations starting to hire people and do more reporting that is online first and radio second. And I think that's an important trend to watch as well, because it's local that is going to make a difference.
Stephen.
Yeah, we're seeing that in Oregon, as a matter of fact. And it's very exciting because, I mean, you do have, if you're the Oregon Public Broadcasting Corporation, and this is true in a lot of states, it's a statewide distribution system. It's trusted. It is, at least in Oregon, number one in drive time. So it's a very powerful way of reaching a large audience. I think there's some hope there.
Bill.
Yes. After I left National Public Radio, I went up to Minnesota Public Radio and ran their news operation. Again, a very, very strong statewide service. I found that you have incredible strength if you have the three legs of the stool, as I call it, great local news combined with great national and international news that NPR and the other services provide. It is really important in those markets, and I'm delighted to see the Corporation for Public Broadcasting supporting more local, strong news at public radio stations.
Here is an email by Bobo. He says, I think newspapers have done a poor job explaining the basics of news gathering. It seems every discussion of journalism leaps to bias and stays there. Personally, I think newspapers could do themselves a favor by explaining the five W's and that pesky H and what it means when a media outlet does not include one or more of them in their output. Stephen.
Well, the web is a great answer to this. As Bill said earlier, when you are working in a digital environment, you can show an awful lot more. You have unlimited space. You can show pictures. You can show documents. You can put up interviews. And I think this will help educate the news-consuming audience as to how these things come together. Because it can seem mysterious. It can seem a little bit random as to why something is in or out. And the other thing that we try to do, you know, is try to address the audience directly. When people write questions to us, as they do, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? We sometimes go out and do it and tell them so.
Stephen Engelberg, he's managing editor of ProPublica. Here's an email from Peter in Tarrytown, New York. He says, one of the issues facing news outlets is the impression of bias to one political party or the other and their lack of credibility to speak truth. Consumers of news favor those sites that support their opinions regardless of its truth. What assurances can you give us that your reporting is not influenced by the social political biases of the foundations supporting you? Bill Buesenberg.
I go back to the firewall that we have between funding, certainly, but we are a nonpartisan, non-advocacy journalism source. We work really hard at going after whatever we think is the right. We can see malfeasance and something that needs to be reported. You know, in the Clinton administration, we're the people who did the Lincoln bedroom story and showed how the White House was selling nights in the Lincoln bedroom. In the Bush administration, we did all kinds of reporting on what's going on there. Now in the Obama administration, we're finding all sorts of things. I believe, yes, there are people who like their news tailored to one side or another, but many, many people are actually citizens who care about, you know, unbiased information, who believe that we need basic core understanding and facts and news gathering that isn't biased, that basically gives people information and lets them make up their own mind. And I'm really proud of the work that we're doing in that score. And I hear from lots of people who say, yes, they need that too. You know, there are all kinds of groups out there advocating one thing or another. All of them, many of them, like to use our work because they show that it's actually based on facts and documents.
All right. One last quick question from Rochester, New York. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning. I do not think the nonprofit model and the NPR model is going to work. I will put forth the evidence that 60% of us, this is actually an old statistic during the late Clinton, early Bush administration, 60% of Americans earn $30,000 a year or less, but organized labor does not have a seat at the table anywhere. Organized labor is nowhere to be found in the coverage in the media. As a matter of fact, Diane, your program, you claimed that money's not influenced in your program, but yet the Wall Street Journal has a seat at your table several times a week. And I would bet that you would be hard-pressed to come up with a handful of times where organized labor has a seat at your table.
Well, surely organized labor has been at this table. Stephen, a comment.
Well, I mean, I think there is another way to look at it. I think what we've tried to do is cover workplace issues at ProPublica. We did some pretty good work on OSHA and its inadequacies. We're currently looking at British Petroleum or BP as a company with a very flawed culture, and we've been looking hard at how workers are treated there. I think that, you know, organized labor doesn't necessarily have a seat at the table, doesn't have to have a seat at the table to have the world of work and labor be covered.
All right, Dan, we'll leave it at that. Stephen Engelberg, he's managing editor of ProPublica. Bill Buesenberg, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. And Ken Doctor, author of Newsonomics. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5. Right now, Global Guru.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in South Africa asking the Zulus, how do you say, I love you?
And then when I was 12 years, I made a piece. It was a love letter, and then I've used my grandmother's beads.
This is Kangwe Dube, author of Talk with Beads. She's teaching me about hidden messages in Zulu beadwork.
Love, it's always a private matter, so you never discuss it like openly. That's why they will always put it down on beadwork. Even if you fall in love with someone, you wouldn't say, I love you.
Instead, you bead it. Dube says unlike most groups in South Africa, the Zulus aren't just designing with beads. They're communicating.
I always said the beadwork of the Zulus are more like the number plates of the cars, because you know exactly where that person comes from by the way they put together the beads, the sequence, the colors that goes together. You tell exactly where that person comes from, which part of the Zululand does she come. Each area now, they've got their own style, their own combination of colors.
The styles often have geometric shapes, like triangles.
Double triangles. So you are telling that person that you are also secured by that person, or maybe you are still a virgin, you're still a young woman, a maiden. Or if it's faced up, it stands for a young man or a married man.
Dube gives me some general color guidelines.
The white is always for good things. Green means even if I'm a child, but I'm old enough to fall in love. The red is also for the full of love. Sometimes the red can be also like if you are angry and then you use the dark red. And then you also get the colors like black. Black, it's like I can't see my way through these difficulties. And then pink in Zulu, they call it isiphofu. Isiphofu meaning poor. So it means if I made a love letter, then I'm saying to this man, so I'm not coming by looking on your wealthy, but I'm just coming here with purely love and I want you to marry me.
Beading is passed down through women's generations. But like any language, it's evolved in the modern world.
I had a project where I was working with the women and HIV/AIDS, and then they were scared of talking about HIV and AIDS. So they were creating dolls and some necklaces, and then behind those dolls and necklaces, you get the message, what they're trying to say. It was quite shocking to hear exactly what's behind the artwork that they produced.
Given the range of subject matter, I asked Dube if it's even possible nowadays to bead a real secret message, one that maybe she can't even read.
I always said if you want to hide something from the Zulu people, you must put it on black and white. But if it's colors, it's very hard to hide anything from us.